This is the first meeting of the New England Fishery Management Council for 2008. This was not a regularly scheduled meeting. However, I've asked for this meeting to be held primarily to put some more time and thought into Amendment 16. I felt it was necessary to get a look at what the committee has done thus far, what the PDT has done thus far, and to give the council an opportunity to review that work ahead of the February meeting. The February meeting, if you remember, is when we had on our timeline for the development of Amendment 16. The February meeting was the time when we, in essence, shut the door to new alternatives. At that point, we take a look at what we've done on the issues, and we don't come up with any new big, great ideas, if possible. And if I've mischaracterized that, hopefully staff or Rip will jump in. But today's an opportunity for the council to review the work that's been done, the discussions and motions that have come out of the committee, and to ask questions and to get more familiar with what's happening. If you look at the agenda for today, the primary issue that's listed on the agenda is the issue of the allocation alternative for sector allocations in Amendment 16. We'll spend a lot of time talking about that today. And if time permits, we will get into other issues that are equally important in Amendment 16 as time permits. So if there's not any questions, I'm going to turn it over to Rip. Paul Howard.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to introduce the council to a new employee we have under a two-year contract, and the public to Ann Hawkins. Ann, do you want to stand up for a minute? Ann is going to work with Tom for Groundfish. We're very lucky to have her. She has a degree in fisheries management, and she's also has a law degree, so she's a lawyer, and she's told us she has all the answers, so we're very fortunate to have Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I usually would say that the committee documents are behind tab number 3, but we take up the entire binder this time, so essentially they're all Groundfish documents. The one that is probably of greatest importance that will be referenced the most is document number 2. Although I think as we work through all of this today, we will likely reference much more than that. I, too, want to take this opportunity to thank the staff and the PDT for all of the work that they have been putting on Amendment 16. It's been a substantial effort, and I certainly, in my position as chair of the committee, thank them. The process to continue to move Amendment 16 forward has been going along since the last council meeting. The committee has held a two-day meeting in December and a one-day meeting in January, and another one-day meeting is scheduled just prior to the next council meeting in February. The PDT has also met twice and held one conference call. As the chairman had indicated, a great deal of effort has been made so that we can continue to meet the timeline milestones that were laid out. And we are doing our best under what I would describe as problematic conditions. Certainly one of the major issues that we're dealing with is the fact that we still do not have guidance from the service on ACLs and AMs. The current schedule that we got during the council chairs meeting a couple of weeks ago in D.C. was that the proposed rule would be out by the end of May and the final rule in August. So we have been trying to set up a process to institute ACLs and AMs. using what we're assuming would be the general guidelines, but we may have to scramble to make changes on that. Again, as the chairman said, the focus of today's meeting is to discuss sector allocation issues, and it's also to familiarize the council with many of the other sector issues and to bring the council up to speed on the work that the committee has been doing on Amendment 16. If we have a presentation from Tom, we will get into discussing the allocation issues, and hopefully we will be able to make some decisions on those and have some alternatives to move forward in the document. With that, I will turn it over to Tom for his presentation.
It's not a good start to a long day. There we go. The presentation is going to focus primarily on one issue, and that is how we allocate or how we determine what each permit can bring to a sector. Generally, in the past, we've referred this to permit history. You will hear me use a term that the PDT coined a couple weeks ago, and I'll use the two terms interchangeably just to make it clear they mean the same thing. And I'm going to refer to it as the potential sector contribution. This is to highlight the issue that, in reality, we're not necessarily allocating something to a specific permit. What we're doing is we're determining what that permit brings into a sector and what gets allocated to the sector as a result of being assigned to that permit. But we have to recognize that for the last year, everybody's been talking about this as how do you calculate permit history for sectors. So that's why you'll see both terms used. I'm going to try and give an overview of the existing provisions in Amendment 13. This, of course, will be the basis of the no-action alternative for the amendment. I'm going to summarize some of the early PDT advice on addressing this issue, some of which perhaps is a little bit dated, but I think it's useful to at least look at that information because it sort of puts into context some of the committee's discussions that have gone on over the summer and fall. I'm going to talk about, at least identify the alternatives that have been raised or considered by the committee, and then actually some of those alternatives have since fallen by the wayside, and the committee has narrowed down to really two alternatives to the no-action alternative. So then I'll try and identify some of the issues with the no-action alternative. I will also try and present some preliminary analyses. We recently, meaning about a half hour ago, discovered a mistake in some of those preliminary analyses. So some of what you have in front of you is probably wrong. I think I can identify to you the specific stocks where the errors are noticeable, and you should ignore that information. It's not all wrong, but some of it is incorrect. So let's review what we said in Amendment 13. When we established sectors in Amendment 13, the first thing we did is we set up a way to calculate the permit history or the potential sector contribution, what every permit brings into a sector. When Amendment 13 went out for public hearing, we actually proposed one of two ideas. Either we were going to allocate days at sea to the sector, or we were going to allocate tax to the sector. In reality, when it came to the vote on Amendment 13, we didn't choose one or the other. We chose both. And if you read Amendment 13, it's at least theoretically possible that a sector could come in and ask for a specific allocation of days at sea and operate under days at sea. Or sectors can operate under a hard tax. What has happened with our two existing sectors is that in reality what they've done is they've chosen both. They haven't chosen either days at sea or tax. They've chosen both days at sea and tax. Now, this creates some problems, I think, that were identified when the Council's Sector Committee discussed things last year. The reality is, in the groundfish plan, that the effort controls, while days at sea are a primary part of the effort controls, they're only a piece of the effort controls. All these things work together. And so you have a situation where what we inadvertently created in Amendment 13 is a situation where a sector can cherry-pick which effort controls govern their behavior for the days at sea part of their fishery. They can, for example, they have to use days at sea while fishing for groundfish, but they're not monitored by trip limits, they're not subject to rolling closures, they're not subject to differential days at sea. So a lot of these elements that are a fundamental part of the effort control system don't apply to our existing sector. So this was early on, I think, it was highlighted by the PDT as an issue quite early in the process after the council vote when we realized how this was being implemented, but it became obvious over the years. Amendment 13 also specifies how each permit's contribution to the TAC coming to the sector will be allocated. And it's actually a fairly simple formula. We take the landings history of the permit and we divide it by the total catch of that stock. Now, this means, the way this is calculated, that because we've had buyouts, because some permits exit the fishery, that in reality you're never going to allocate your, even if everybody were to choose to join a sector, it's not going to add up to 100% of the allocation, because the total catch piece is fixed in time. The landings part of each permit, some of those permits are gone. So, you know, their piece has vanished. But this is how Amendment 13 described it. The most confusing part in Amendment 13 with respect to determining each permit's contribution was the time period. In Amendment 16, for the most part, we adopted a sliding five-year period. The language in the amendment says your permit's history will be calculated based on the most recent five-year period before sector implementation. Now, the service has actually had to interpret that a little bit because logically that would mean if you start fishing in fishing year 2005, your permit history goes through fishing year 2004. The reality is, however, that the service doesn't have the data available that quickly in order to calculate those numbers. So there's actually a little bit of a lag built into that, quote, most recent five-year period. Just to give you an example, the service has told us that for sectors that plan to beginning fishing in fishing year 2009, any period that they're going to use to calculate these values ends with landings from fishing year 2006. There's another rather odd glitch in the amendment, and that is that for Georges Bank Cod, we fixed the time period for a while. This was because the one sector approved in Amendment 13 asked for a TAC only for Georges Bank Cod. And for fishing, they were subject to fishing year 96 through 2001 was the time period for the amendment. And so the council decided that at least for the first couple years of the amendment, they would use that same time period when it came to allocating Georges Bank Cod. But then for any sector beginning to fish in fishing year 2007 or later, everything would revert to the most recent five-year period for all stocks. Now, it's worth talking about these points a little bit. The first is, why did we pick a sliding period? This was not an accidental decision. We recognized at the time that Amendment 13 was written that there were some permits that, because of low stock size or fisheries regulations, there were some permits that might not have history during that 96-2001 time period. As the fish rebuild, the fish may re-enter those areas, and then those permits really wouldn't have the opportunity to form a sector to target those species. So we intentionally chose the sliding five-year time period, recognizing that, you know, this might create an opportunity for some boats that perhaps didn't have history in 96-2001 to form sectors in the future as the stocks rebuilt and as they acquired history fishing on the stocks. Well, that was a perhaps a good idea, but over the years, I think we recognized that there were some problems caused by that. And I think some of those problems, without going into all of them, probably outweighed the benefits of providing these opportunities for people to fish for history. Just as an example, one problem in it is that it's at least theoretically possible for a boat to enter a sector, fish hard in the sector for 4 or 5 years, and then leave and form another sector and take that history with them with a different history period. The sliding history period also complicates calculations of sector shares if you have sectors that form at different times. It is not really correct to say that, you know, your shares add up to more than 100%, because there are ways to do the calculation to prevent that. But the fact is, you got to do it that way, and it does complicate the issue a little bit. And so you really don't know. And a third point is that you really don't know what each permit has or brings to the sector, because what he brings to the sector depends on what time he chooses to join a sector, because that determines when his history period is, when his contribution is calculated. So for any permit holder, potentially his share is changing every year. You know, what he might take to a sector is changing every year. So those are just some of the complications that were identified after we adopted this thing. And, you know, quite honestly, these were discussed further by the Council's Omnibus Sector Committee, and the Council's Omnibus Sector Committee came down and said, you know, a couple things. First, you should be required to have a tag for everything you catch in the sector, so that does away with the days at sea thing. That's now a council policy. And the second thing that they came up with is they said you should have a fixed time period. And they recognize that in an individual plan, it's possible that parts of your plan, the fixed time period, might want to be different for reasons specific to a plan. But you should just have a fixed time period to avoid these sliding baseline issues. So that's where we were at the beginning of the summer. We had the council sector policy recommending a hard tack on all species and a fixed baseline. And then the PDT met to try and prepare for the committee. I think all of you have got this PDT memo in your binder. It's a memo. There's actually a conference call in late June where we identified some issues, and I'm not sure that date is right, August 25th. It might be July 25th. But anyway, then there was a couple PDT meetings where we came together and we provided some advice to the committee. The committee met towards the end of August. And one piece of advice I think that I'd like to reiterate is that if you're going to base allocation solely on landings history, I think that the objective is relatively apparent. You're trying to divide the fishery up and determine the potential sector contribution based on people's performance during a given time period. You're trying to match how their performance, the results of their performance during that time period, and carry it forward into your potential sector contribution formula. But if you're going to use elements other than landings history, it becomes somewhat muddy about what it is you're really trying to do. And I think the PDT thinks that it's important that if the council is going to consider those other elements, if you're going to consider using other elements, you should try and make a clear statement of what are the objectives you're trying to accomplish by using those other elements, so that when you ask the PDT or the public what they think of these alternatives, they have something to measure them against, and they can determine whether or not the alternative is meeting those objectives that you set. When it comes to fixed time period, we felt that there were some logical boundaries on the time period. The last year, I think, that you can use for any time period, at least if you're time period for landings history. The last year you can really use, if you're going to start a sector in 2009, is fishing year 2006. That's because the service needs to have data available and time available to calculate the potential sector contributions. And they need, if you think about fishing year 2007, it doesn't end until April in 2008. The data may not be available until later that year. In the case of some state landings data, it doesn't come in until the next year, potentially. So you can see that if a sector really wants to start operating May 1st, 2009, the last year of data that's really available is the data for fishing year 2006. when it comes to the beginning of the period, occasionally people have suggested, at least in writing and letters and emails and phone calls to the council or the council staff, that, you know, we shouldn't be feeling bound to the period since Amendment 5. We should be looking back at history back in the early 80s, because I caught a lot more fish in the early 80s. The problem with that is that, you know, if you recall, one of the reasons that Amendment 5 adopted a two-tier reporting system, our current dealer and VTR reporting system, is because when we tried to assign effort based on landings in Amendment 5, there was considerable concern that the data was not adequate to do so. And this is in part one of the rationales for going to the Fleet 88, what's called an 88-day permit. It isn't 88 days now. But anyway, that's what led to that decision. So in our opinion, it's really kind of unlikely that you could extend the period back before the two-tier reporting system of fishing year 1994. Quite honestly, I think you'd have trouble using 1994. That was the first year that the systems were in place. We know that there are some holes in the data that not everybody reported. Our experience with the existing sectors is that the older the data is, the more problems you have with it, because either the records are gone or the record the vessel has doesn't match up with the dealer data. Dealers are out of business. You can't track it down. And so while 1994 might really be the outside bounds, I think if you actually look at the PDT memo, we suggest really starting about 1996. There's another complication. You know, when you look at these years, ideally you'd like to try and find a year where, or you'd like to find a series of years where perhaps things were relatively stable or access to the fishery was the same for all segments of the fishery. Well, we looked at that and we found one day, perhaps, where that was true. I mean, the reality is that there were so many management measure changes and so many regulatory changes that it's very difficult to find a window where you can follow that, what would be the ideal situation. But we would point out that beginning with Amendment 13 in fishing year 2004, the council adopted a number of things that do complicate, or at least, well, do complicate and make you have to think a little bit about the implications of using the years for Amendment 13. We adopted the leasing program, of course, special access programs, the Category B day at sea program, and these kind of complicate your history question. I'll go into the leasing program in a little bit more detail in a second, but, for example, the special access programs. Not everybody had access to every special access program. For example, the Eastern U.S. Canada Haddock SAP for the first couple years of existence until Framework 42, I believe, was adopted, was only eligible to trawl vessels to target haddock. There was no opportunity for longline vessels or gillnet vessels to participate in that SAP. The Category B Day at Sea program, of course, which allowed people to use B days at seas to target certain species, was kind of limited based on what we thought the stock status of those species were. And so if you look at the Category B Day at Sea program, as we did for Framework 42, you see that it was primarily used to target species on George's Bank, George's Bank winter flounder, skates to a certain extent, George's Bank haddock. So the opportunities for some vessels to use B days were rather limited. We had the Closed Area 1 Hook Gear Haddock SAP. This was an opportunity, of course, only for longline vessels. In its first year of operation, it was only available to sector participants. It was not available to longline vessels at all. Common pool longline vessels at all. And the council actually did include language in the framework that adopted this SAP that said, landings history generated in the SAP will not be used in determining history for any future action. Now, it's unclear to me whether the council intends to stand by that statement, but in any case, that statement is in the document. Now, one of the other things, and this particular piece of information perhaps might be a little bit dated, but it's still worth considering. When the Magnuson-Stevens Act was passed, it included a lot of language on limited access privilege programs. It included some language on things that councils should consider when they set up these limited access privilege programs. And it goes into considerable detail about things like future community access, access for new participants, all types of things that you may want to consider when you set up a limited access privilege program. Now, at the time the PDT wrote this memo, we did not know whether or not sectors would be considered a LAP. Since we wrote that memo, of course, the council's received a letter from the regional office that says that in the opinion of NOAA General Counsel, sectors are not LAPs. So there is no requirement to consider those things that are mentioned in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Council, of course, could always choose to consider them, but there's no requirement to consider those things when determining initial allocations.
Tom, one second.
Just a point on that letter. Didn't it say the current two SAPs we have are not LAPs, but any future sectors may be considered LAPs? Is that what it said?
It did. It didn't provide any guidance, however, on what changes would turn them into LAPs. And so we don't, I mean, I guess that's a possibility. We're operating under the assumption so far, and hasn't been challenged by the attorney at the committee meetings, that what we've done so far has not triggered them to being a LAP. Hopefully he would have said something by now if he thought the types of changes we were talking about would do that. I'd like to go into the leasing complications a little bit, because this is one that I think is important. It can sometimes be a little difficult to understand, so I've tried to create some drawings here. We'll see if they work. The big bullseye, I don't work for Target. The big bullseye in the middle here is intended to try and indicate, you know, you've got the fishery as a whole, all right? And you can look at that as either the history of landings or whatever, but you've got the fishery as a whole. And the way we operate before sectors is that, you know, it doesn't really matter. The fishery catches fish. The fishery uses days at sea. It's all one piece. And if you look at each permit generates history. And there are a lot of different elements, as the region has pointed out to us. There are tons of elements that go into permit history. But two of them tend to think of most often are the days at sea that are used and the landings that are generated by that permit. And both the days at sea and the landings prior to Amendment 13 stayed on one permit. They moved together. And if you actually go back into, you know, this concept here is kind of fundamental. If you go back to some of the early development of Amendment 13 and qualification criteria, one of the fundamental concepts, I'm sorry, of Amendment 5, not 13, one of the fundamental concepts there is that you can't generate, two permits can't qualify for the fishery based on the same piece of history. That's always been an underlying element in the groundfish plan. You know, one permit or one vessel generates one bit of history and it stays with that vessel. So when we form sectors, the concept behind sectors is you take this circle for the fishery, and you split it up. And at least the theory behind the concept is that, you know, depending on, you know, I'm showing halves here, it's just an illustration. The idea is that, you know, the people that stay in the common pool have whatever their history gave them, and the people that move in the sector have whatever their history gave them. And if you add up those two pieces, son of a gun, it all adds up to one. It all stays the same. Now, what happens with leasing, however, and this is kind of interesting, I think. It's difficult to illustrate, but just to try it. When we have leasing, something different happens with a permit. As you recall, when someone leases days to another permit, the history of the days that are used goes to the permit that originally owned the days. The landings go to the permit that generated the landings. The history gets split. So in essence, we've got one piece of fishing activity where someone went out and used days at sea. He caught fish. But now that, in essence, generates history on two boats. It generates days at sea use history on the first permit, and it generates landings history on the second permit. So what you do now with the history calculation matters. because potentially what occurs here is, this is not a terribly good illustration, but potentially if you look at this circle as landings, what happens is if permit 2 joins a sector, he takes his landings with him, but all the days he used to generate those landings stay over on permit 1. And if permit 1 does not join a sector, but if permit 1 remains in the common pool, then there's a mismatch between how many days remain in the common pool and how many landings or potential sector contribution, if you prefer, remains in the common pool. And so, you know, your landings piece, the connection between the two changes. I hope I'm getting the point across. The idea here is that you're taking landings that might result from the days at sea that are in the common pool, and you're putting them in the sector. In essence, what you've done is you've generated two pieces of history from one fishing activity, and you put it in two different places. And now both of those pieces of history can go out fishing, and so you've created a disconnect. Now, the potential problem here, particularly for vessels that choose to remain in the common pool, especially with the advent of annual catch limits and those types of things, is that they're going to have more days at sea in the common pool than fish to support those days at sea. So this is an issue that the PDT highlighted to the committee. We offered several suggestions for how to address it that are in that memo that I referred to. You know, just to go over some of those options, you can require permits joining sectors to somehow take enough days at sea in to cover their landings. You can change your qualification periods, for example, so that it doesn't include the leasing period. There's a couple ideas, and there may be more. So the committee started to work on options, and we came up with, at one time, there were 7 different options here for potential sector contributions. It started out, we looked at landings history alone, 2 periods, one that did not include, they both basically started the same, but one that did not include the time period for Amendment 13, in part because of these concerns over leasing and special access programs. So that gives us 2 options. Then we added 4 more options. We used a combination of landings history and used days at sea. We were weighting these two differently, either weighting them equally or weighting them 75-25 with a heavier weight to landings history. And once again, we considered 2 time periods, 96 to 2001, 96 to 2006. Then we included a 7th option. This was a landings history and capacity formula. The time period was 96 to 2006. The formula is 10 times the length plus the horsepower times the allocated A days. Now, I want to point out that the original form of this is going to look very similar to an option you're going to see in a minute here. But the original form of this allocation said that the capacity part of the formula applies to stocks in the area that were fished by the permit. So what does that mean? Well, what that means is, let's suppose you've got a permit that fished in the Gulf of Maine and the only thing you ever landed was Gulf of Maine cod. That means that the capacity part of the formula would give you a small piece of not only Gulf of Maine cod, but would give you a piece of Gulf of Maine haddock, plaice, witch flounder, redfish, pollock, anything caught in the Gulf of Maine. But assuming you had never fished outside of the Gulf of Maine or your permit had never fished outside of the Gulf of Maine, it would not give you any allocation of southern New England yellowtail flounder, as an example. So you would get something for every place you had fished, but you wouldn't get something if you hadn't fished in that stock area. Those 7 options were cut down by the committee and narrowed, and the committee recommendations currently is really for just 3 options. No action alternative, obviously, is required under NEPA, and that would be the sliding most recent 5-year period, landings history alone. Then an option based on landings history alone for fishing years 96 through 2006. and an option that weights equally landings history plus a capacity component, the same time period. The capacity component is the same formula you saw before. I got a few more parentheses in there to make it clearer, but anyway, it's the same formula. I'm sorry, it's not the same formula. It's times allocated A days, not used A days. But not insignificant difference is that the formula is only applied to stocks that are caught. So if you use my example of the boat that only fished in the Gulf of Maine and only landed Gulf of Maine cod, in the earlier version, he got Gulf of Maine haddock as part of his capacity formula. In this version, all he gets is Gulf of Maine cod on his capacity formula. So that's the difference between the two. Now, we tried to analyze some impacts, and I'm going to point out where the errors are here. And unfortunately, it's right in the first slide and in a couple other slides. We found some errors in the impact analysis with respect to vessel size for four stocks: Southern New England winter flounder, Cape Cod Gulf of Maine yellowtail, Georgia's yellowtail, and I want to say it's another winter flounder. Anyway, there's three flatfish in the middle. So anything you've got that's based on vessel size that it lumps everything together has got some errors in it that I need to fix. I've got the data with me today. I didn't get a chance to actually do the slides. If the committee is interested, it would probably only take me a few minutes to redo the slides during lunch or during a break or something to at least show you so you have a better idea what the errors amount to. But I can still use this slide to explain to you what it is we did. The first thing we did is Eric Thunberg at the center calculated for each permit what his share was or what its potential sector contribution was under each of the alternatives that we had before us. And we get a table of percentages. And you've got some of those tables in front of you in the binder. And then what we did is we calculated a target tack for fishing year 2009. We adjusted for recreational catch and Canadian catch and those types of things and came up with a number that said, okay, this is about what they're going to catch. So we in some slides, we multiplied the shares times the pounds. That's easy enough to do. And then we created some slides that show you in aggregate what these different groups get. And the two groups we did was vessel size, large being vessels over 70 feet, medium 50 to 70, small under 50 feet. And then we did it by home port state, which is the home port state that's claimed on the permit. In some cases, people don't land in their home port state, but that's what we used for the analysis. So then the other thing we did is we then calculated a gross average price for calendar year 2007, and we multiplied the pounds by the average price to get sort of a value of, this is what the value is of each permit's potential sector contribution. Then we added them all together and showed them up in aggregate as well. The idea behind doing that is because if you look at some of the tables, you'll see that, a category may get an increase, for example, in Gulf of Maine cod. They may get a decrease in which flounder. Well, if you're just looking at the pounds, it's difficult to tell what that means. When you're comparing alternatives, you don't really know what that means, how that impacts the vessels. Converted all to dollars, it's kind of all on the same metric. Even if there's a lot of assumptions in the paper, we point out, there's no guarantee that the prices, of course, would stay the same or that the 2007 prices represent future prices, for example. There are a lot of other issues involved, but you can read those assumptions. And most of the errors are in the history-only small vessel category. That's where the largest error, I think, is probably in Cape Cod, Gulf of Maine, yellowtail. If you look at the chart on your table, you'll see that it shows small vessels under history-only have 0% of Cape Cod yellowtail. That's just wrong. There was a typo when we put it together. So here's what it looks like on states. These numbers are correct. This is the value without Georgia's Bank Haddock values included. You'll see charts in your paper that show both with Georgia's Haddock and without. One of the problems we have is the target TAC that we use for Georgia's Bank Haddock was calculated several years ago. It's humongous, and it warps every analysis, and so everything gets driven by whoever is catching Georgia's Bank Haddock. I think you might get a little bit better picture of how these interact if you look, if you use both charts. And you can see that there's differences. For example, if you look at the state of New Hampshire, home port state vessels, under either alternative, they seem to do worse than under the no action alternative. I say seem to because I would expect a little bit of change there with the Cape Cod Yellowtail correction that I told you about, but they seem to do worse. If you look at Massachusetts, they seem to do perhaps marginally better under the history-only alternative compared to no action, but the 50-50 capacity alternative seems to show them doing a little worse under both. Once again, these will all be revised with the corrected numbers, but that's what these are the types of analyses we tried to do. The other thing to point out is that you have to remember here, these are all on the same scale. And so, what appears to be a small change for Massachusetts, pound-wise, the same number might turn out to be a huge percentage change for a state like New York or New Jersey, even though the pound change is the same. Another series of charts is shown, and obviously this is the one in error, is the Cape Cod Gulf of Maine Yellowtail one on the right. So we did the same thing with pounds. We said, where are these pounds going? If you look for Gulf of Maine cod, for example, if you look under the no action alternative, which is the white bar to the right, most of the Gulf of Maine cod goes to the small vessels, the 50, I shouldn't say most. But anyway, you see the small vessels get more under the no action alternative than they do under either other alternative. And as you go to the capacity formula, Gulf of Maine cod for large vessels, more of it goes to the large vessels. We think this actually makes sense. If you recall back on frame, makes sense from the standpoint of other data we've looked at, not necessarily makes sense from what your objective might be. But if you look at some of the data we developed for Framework 42, for example, it clearly showed that in the case of Gulf of Maine cod, since 1994 or 1996, more and more of the Gulf of Maine cod is being caught by small vessels, and that less and less of it was being caught by larger vessels. So you have to remember that under the no-action alternative, we're using the most recent five-year time period. That's a time period where, according to data we've looked at before, large vessels didn't catch much Gulf of Maine cod. Now, if you turn to the other two alternatives, you've got two things going on here. One is that you're using a longer history period. So you're using a history period where some large boats did fish for Gulf of Maine cod in the Gulf of Maine. So you're adding them into the history period. And then if you're talking the capacity formula, the capacity formula also gives a piece of Gulf of Maine cod if someone fished there to boats. So that also bumps it up there. That's why it goes up between the history only and the capacity formula for Gulf of Maine cod. So when we look at these things, we looked at these and we took at least a minute and we said, well, this does seem to be consistent with other data we've looked at, the results that are coming up. I've got a series of these charts. These two are correct when it comes to vessel size. This shows metric tons, where the fish go for Georgia's Bank cod and Georgia's Bank haddock. And if you look in the paper, I went through it for all the groundfish stocks. They're all in there. I'm not going to show them all on the screen here. As I pointed out, the errors are for Southern New England Yellowtail, Southern New England Winter, Cape Cod Yellowtail, and Georgia's Yellowtail, I think. The biggest mistake seems to be Cape Cod Yellowtail, which, of course, is a pretty small tack in fishing year 2009, so it won't change the aggregate numbers too much. But there are some errors, like I said, in some of the other ones that are pretty minor. So I'm getting to the conclusion of my presentation before the council discussion starts. I think there's a couple points that need to be reiterated. The first is I would strongly encourage the council, as you work on these alternatives, to be very clear about what the objectives are for whichever alternatives you decide to push forward. You know, what is the rationale? Why, if you're considering things other than landing history, what is it, the reason for considering those other elements? And more importantly, what is it you're trying to accomplish while considering those other elements so that the PDT has an idea of how to measure whether that alternative is doing what you're trying to do or not? I think there's an important point that the council at least ought to be sensitive to, and that is that you need to be concerned a little bit, or at least recognize that there are implications in this method for those who have invested in Days at Sea. Days at Sea is the only thing that we've really allocated to fishermen so far. People argue that once we start doing potential sector contributions or permit histories for a large number of vessels, you know, some people argue that you're allocating to the fishery based on those things. And, you know, we have a lot of permit holders who have invested in buying permits, and they have looked at trying to acquire permits that have Days at Sea attached to them, and perhaps have not been very concerned about whether they had landings history attached to them. And so if you now switch how you're determining potential sector contributions to be focused on landing history, I think you at least need to be sensitive to the fact that there are implications for those who have invested heavily in Days at Sea, and those, in some cases, may be serious implications. I think there's another point that the council should be very clear on, if only, hopefully, to avoid some future confusion. Most of us here are well aware of the angst in Amendment 13 caused by the so-called use-it-or-lose-it debate, whether the council had ever promised or not promised that if you did not use Days at Sea, you would not lose them, and yet here in Amendment 13, that's exactly what we're doing. I think the council should be very clear and upfront with the industry about whether the decisions you're making on the potential sector contribution now are intended to or can bind the council's decisions if you move forward a couple of years from now in developing an area management system or an ITQ system or a point system or any of the other alternatives that were raised during scoping on Amendment 13, Amendment 16, sorry. Now, you know, this may be a very easy statement to make. I mean, we've been advised by council numerous times that the council cannot bind the hands of future councils, but I think it would be useful to make a clear statement at some point about whether you feel that you're being bound by these decisions or intend to use this as guidance. The last point is that there are a number of technical issues with respect to calculating these capacity factors. These are listed in the PDT report. Some of them are listed in a committee report that we're working on, hasn't been distributed yet. Just to give you an example, any limited access permit is eligible to join a sector, according to one of the recommendations of the committee. That includes, for example, hand gear A permits. Well, if you adopt a formula that's based on, that includes Days at Sea, hand gear A permits don't get Days at Sea. They were never allocated them. They can't qualify for them. That's why they're hand gear A permits. So how do you deal with that Day at Sea piece in the capacity formula for hand gear A permits? It's not just hand gear A permits. You also have limited access permits that may have small amount of landings and thus qualify on the landings portion of the component, but they may not have qualified for any Days at Sea, so they've got 0 days at sea. I can go into more of those technical issues later. Those are ones that perhaps can be dealt with after the committee or after the council decides more on what the alternatives are that they want to send forward. But there are a number of technical issues that need to be addressed. Another technical issue that I don't think has had any discussion at the committee is, do these changes affect existing sectors' potential sector contribution? Are we recalculating everybody, every stock for everybody, or do the existing sectors keep their same share of Georges Bank cod? I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think it's really been discussed yet by the committee. So you can see that there are still some technical things to be figured out after the broader issue of what are these alternatives going to look like gets rectified, decided. I can answer any questions, or the chair can.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Anyone on the council? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Tom, the figure that you showed with preliminary impacts by state for the three alternatives, that's on page 3 of the handout, the one specifically that says without Georgia's Bank Haddock. Visually, you look at this and you see that there really are no meaningful differences between the three alternatives. I say visually because obviously on the y-axis you've got those large numbers. In light of all of the uncertainty that must go into this analysis, how much credibility do these analyses, these comparative analyses, have, recognizing they're still preliminary? Again, visually, I see nothing here. It doesn't impact me. Maybe if I saw a table with numbers, I'd have a different point of view. But again, how much, at this point in time, to what extent should we feel that those preliminary impacts should influence our decisions?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that. I think you have to be a little careful looking at these bars. If you look at the medium and small bar, for example, I think the difference in alternatives probably is about 20% of the value for those, just eyeballing it. I'm not sure I'd call that not meaningful. The percentage is obviously a smaller difference for the large vessel size because they land more, even though the dollar value differences are probably about the same. I'm not sure I can go any further than that on this at this point.
Anyone else in the council? Dave.
Thanks. Could you explain a little bit how the capacity formula was derived? Was that empirical, or how did you relate horsepower, length, and so forth?
Well, to be clear, the capacity formula wasn't developed by the PDT. Okay, it was developed. It actually is similar to some formulas that came out during the point system discussions. It's similar to some formulas that were developed by a group that was working on an industry-funded buyout. I'm not real familiar with all of the, I'm not familiar with hardly any of the analyses that went into developing that formula. I will point out that one of the analyses that we've also done is we've looked at some of these formulas to see if they're correlated with landings history, and the answer is, yeah, they kind of seem to be. You know, the correlation is relatively high for the element of length. It's not so high for the element of horsepower, for example, and it's high for days at sea. I really can't speak to how the formula was generated because we didn't generate it.
Anyone else on the council? Dr. Pierce?
Just a couple of other points, clarifications, really. Make sure I understood what you said. During the early part of your presentation, you said that because of the sliding baseline, it's possible for a complication to arise, and that complication would be, tell me if I'm right, that if a sector decides to have a relatively few number of vessels within the sector harvest the allocation that it has, that catch history goes with those few vessels. Therefore, if those few vessels leave the sector, they bring all their history with them. Hence, the sector it shoots itself in its own foot. Am I correctly interpreting, describing what you said, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, that is, I'm not sure that's exactly what I said, but that is a follow-on of what I said. That's exactly what I was talking about, is that if a small number of vessels fish on the sector's allocation, they can then leave the sector and go somewhere else and, with a new time period, you know, generate a sector with a different set of history in it.
Under existing rules?
Under existing rules.
Okay,
yes.
But under existing rules, would it be possible for a sector through its operations plan to prevent that from happening?
Well, perhaps.
I mean, I don't know if they could have some contract which prohibits people from leaving the sector or penalizes them should they choose to do so. They could also perhaps develop a way to make sure that the catch is distributed to all members of the sector. What I do not think that they can do at present under existing rules, and NIMS may correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think they can say that I catch it, but you get the landings history. I don't think the sector could do that.
All right, thank you. One final question. I need you to point me to the right document because we have so many, including duplicates. You mentioned a very important point early on, and that is that if a number of vessels go into a sector, they bring their catch history with them, but their days at sea, through leasing, their catch history goes with them, but the days at sea stay with the vessel that would be in the common pool because that vessel decided not to get into the sector. You said that the plan development team had some recommendations as to how we possibly could deal with that issue. What document describes those suggestions?
It's document 10. The suggestions are on page 6 and 7 of that document.
You all set, Dr. Pierce? Dave?
Yeah, Tom, in this graph, I'm kind of interested in the left-hand axis. You've used value instead of pounds, and I assume there's a reason for that. You've somehow correlated pounds with value. They used it as a proxy, and I assume it smooths things out quite a bit. If we did this on a species-by-species basis for pounds instead of value, would these graphs, I believe these graphs would look substantially different. Is that true?
Well, let me answer your first question. We used value in order to try and get everything on a common currency. The problem with looking at all the pounds tables, for example, is, okay, well, you know, if I lose a pound of which flounder, but gain a pound of cod, is that a plus or a minus? You know, I don't know the answer to that. It's difficult to make those comparisons when you're looking at a large table. So we tried to do sort of a common currency, which is why we did it on value. Now, I don't have them created because it winds up being a lot of graphs, but you know, we can do exactly what you said. We can, for example, create a similar chart relatively easily that says, okay, Gulf of Maine cod value, where does it go? Which flounder value, where does it go? You know, how do these compare? So that rather than the total on the side of the value, it's just the value of Gulf of Maine cod. We can do that. I don't know offhand if it's going to look different than this or not because I haven't actually done that work. But, I mean, that's not – it's just doing a bunch of graphs.
Okay. Table. Well, the reason I ask is because everything that's in the Groundfish Committee report is landings in pounds. If we're going to assign allocation based on value, that would be an entirely different equation. And it might actually ultimately be a fairer one because at some point people have converted opportunity to value. And you know, a guy who catches 1,000 pounds of monkfish, he's done as well as a guy who catches 4,000 pounds of cod, maybe. You know, in other words, people, this is getting at this issue that I've had from day one with this problem with landings, is that people didn't fish for landings other than those who were trying to accumulate history because they think they're going to get something out of it. People fish for value. They fish for dollars. And that's the reason I'm so interested in this, because this is a different way of presenting this from anything that's been done in the committee that I can see so far. And, you know, it may represent a different way of going out and getting out from underneath this landings gorilla, if we just, you know, somehow equate value with a number of pounds of stuff you can go catch. I'm not saying that's the answer. I'm just putting this out there that this is different from what is in these three alternatives. These three alternatives are all based on landings, not dollars.
Rip.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a point concerning Dr. Pierce's question on history were calculated on a go-forward basis with rolling, with a rolling five-year time frame, and the fact that some boats could accumulate a lot of catch history and then take it out of the sector somewhere else. And Tom can correct me on this if I got it wrong, but that gets resolved if we have a fixed time period and we establish the allocations one time on a percentage basis, and then those percentages always that share always stays with the permit going forward, no matter what happens. So that's certainly one way of mitigating that.
Paul.
Tom, as you recall, when the council did its omnibus upgrade amendment, we had a significant discussion about how arbitrary horsepower was in determining capacity, but kept it in anyway. And I see that this formula for capacity includes length and horsepower. Is the PDT or the committee intent to use the existing permit baseline that NIMS has?
Well, this is actually one of the technical issues that needs to be resolved. The discussion all along has been that we will use the permit baseline for a permit, and specifically the groundfish baseline. In reality, a lot of permits have a lot of baselines, and in some cases they have more than one groundfish baseline. They may have a temporarily reduced groundfish baseline for leasing. So not only do we need to be clear at some point about which baseline we're going to use, but I think there's also a need to be clear about when the calculation is going to be done. Because if permits combine or get transferred, there can be some changes in baseline, and the service needs to know, you know, what state of nature do they use when they do these calculations.
John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Tom, I might have missed or misunderstood what you said on one of your last comments, and that was dealing with the existing sectors versus potentially future sectors and the calculation of their allocation. And I thought we had addressed that whatever committee it was, Omnibus Sector Committee. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chairman, you probably have a better recollection than I. I thought we addressed that, and so that if we were, that all sectors were going to be dealing with a common baseline, depending on the species, for the future. And that we weren't going to have differential, i.e. a sliding versus a fixed for the same species for different sectors. So if I misunderstood what Tom was saying, I'd like that clarified. But if I'm correct on what I'm saying in regard to what he said, I think we ought to have that in our minds.
Yeah, I think what Tom was doing was presenting what's in the regulations right now under the groundfish plan. I think there's a document in here. I'm not sure. I think it's number 3 that talks about the changes that would – the changes that the policy the council adopted for sectors – those changes, how they would apply to 13, there's in Amendment 16, there's blocks of text that are shaded over. I think that's brought out in that text. But I think Tom was just pointing out what the status quo option is for NEPA purposes. And you're right, the sector committee and the sector policy that the council adopted did say that for an FMP, sectors in that FMP will have a fixed allocative baseline. Anyone else on the council? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, I had a question on the leasing slide that you showed. I'm trying to get a sense of how big that problem is, and I'm wondering, it shows some proportions between the two halves of the ring when leasing is included. And I'm curious as to how real that differential is in proportion. How big is the problem is what I'm asking.
Well, I don't know the answer. I mean, the picture is just intended to be a cartoon to illustrate the point. It's not intended to suggest that it's to scale of what the problem is. And the reason, one of the reasons why that I don't know how big the problem is, because I don't really know who is joining sectors or what their landing history is or what sort of fishing activity their landing history is based on. If everybody joins a sector and has never used a lease day, well, then this problem isn't a problem at all. You know? On the other hand, if they use a lot of lease days in order to acquire a lot of history and they plan on leaving those lease days in the common pool, well, then it might be a problem. And somewhere in the middle is the point where, you know, maybe some of these guys are intending to take all of their permits into the sector with them. Well, you know, then it may not be as big a problem either.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone else? Okay. Go to the audience for a few questions if there are any. No one in the audience? Okay. Back to Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At this point, I believe that what we should do is put the three committee alternatives up on the table. And I think that's where we would should start the move the discussion forward. So I don't know if Karen's got them. These are just getting hooked back up. On behalf of the Groundfish Committee, I recommend that the Council consider these three alternatives. One is no action. The history associated with each permit joining a sector will be calculated based on landings from the most recent five-year period prior to the sector's implementation. For sectors starting operations on 1 May 2009, NIMS has determined this period will be fishing years 2002 through 2006. What we are calling here alternative one, the history associated with each permit joining a sector will be calculated based on landings during the period fishing year 1996 through fishing year 2006. And alternative two, the history associated with each permit joining a sector will be calculated based on two factors that are weighted equally: landings during the period fishing year 1996 through 2002, and a factor calculated from permit baseline length, horsepower, and allocated days at sea.
Paul. Wouldn't it be better before the council votes is to look at the number one issue that Tom had and say, what are the objectives of these two different alternatives? And so then you can have a, once you know the objectives, then you might have a better discussion. But I think that's one of the keys that the PDT said, is that they haven't, the council hasn't communicated the objectives of why we would want just history and why the council would want a combination of history and capacity. So I would hope that though that issue of the objectives of each of these comes out during this deliberation.
That's what I was going to say. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I would move to take this motion. This is a motion on behalf of the committee, correct? Okay, I would move to table this motion until after the council determines the objectives for allocation.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Gaethel. All those in favor, please raise your hand. I have seven. Opposed? Eight. The motion to table fails. Dr. Pierce.
Okay, so we'll do this before we determine what we want to do. Okay. All right. sends a message to me that I won't describe at this point in time. All right. The reason why I wanted to postpone our discussion about this particular recommendation from the committee is that after this motion was made and this decision was made, the snowstorm hit, and our committee meeting was cut relatively short. And subsequent to that, the meeting being over, we certainly did receive quite a bit of comment, the committee received quite a bit of comment regarding the committee's decision. And in particular, I refer the council to what I consider to be an extremely important letter or document, and that's number 14. It's relevant to the motion. Number 14, the Northeast Seafood Coalition letter that describes the coalition's specific concerns about this action taken by the committee and that now, of course, this council is going to consider. In particular, the coalition noted some very important things. Use such words as grave concern about the decision made by the committee, said such things as our decision as a committee effectively invalidated all of the goals, objectives, rationale, and intended results of the main motion, which, again, is relative to allocation. And let's not kid ourselves. This is the allocation amendment. This is it. This is when we allocate. Consequently, we must be very careful in terms of what our objectives are, what we're trying to accomplish. In the fourth paragraph, it mentions disastrous results of the amended version, mentions poison pills. Now, I highlight their particular concerns and opinions because the coalition, as we all know, has been speaking on behalf of representing many, many sectors. Therefore, I take notice of what they have to say. And that's one reason why I, at the committee meeting, asked if there would be an opportunity for the plan development team in particular to pay close attention to a very comprehensive side-by-side comparison of alternatives that they've also attached to their letter. I would hope that we would have an opportunity to see or to hear what has happened, if anything, recognizing there wasn't much time for the plan development team to reflect on the side-by-side comparison. But I need to have some resolution, some opinion expressed by our technical people regarding whether or not there is validity to the claims made by the coalition. If there is validity, then I suspect we need to revisit this motion or amend this motion and to include another option. So my question to you, Mr. Chairman, is through you to or through Tom, do we have any additional insights regarding the validity of all of the important points made by the coalition that they have stressed so emphatically?
Before I get to your specific question, Dr. Pierce, just give people a little roadmap for the rest of the day. This is the core issue for this discussion today. That's why we're here. It's the core issue. I felt it was appropriate to put the motion on the table so people could see what the committee had arrived at on this core issue. It doesn't mean that I'm going to call for a vote anytime soon. So I wanted to have the issue up there, the three alternatives up there. The PDT has further technical questions. The council members have questions. The audience has questions on these three points. I intend to spend a lot of time kicking this thing around. But just so people understand, we're not calling the question anytime soon. I just felt it was appropriate. It's in the agenda. It's the primary point or reason that we're here. To your specific question, I'm going to turn it over to Rick Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to make the same points, too. I voted against tabling it because I think we need something up there that we can focus on and discuss. And this is the time and place where if we need to make modifications or amendments to that to those motions, that's where this is where it should be done. And if we need to complete the rationale for why we're picking one of them, this is the place that we need to work on that. to your question concerning whether the PDT has had some discussion on the comparison and the issues brought up by the Northeast Seafood Coalition. They have done that. I don't know, Tom, if you're prepared to make any comments on that at this point in time.
We did have the discussion. We prepared a report. Unfortunately, not all the PDT members had a chance to read the report, so I didn't bring, I didn't print out copies because not everyone has concurred in what was written. I do have the report here with a caveat that, you know, there may be some minor changes to it. I don't think I missed too much of the discussion. I can go through the report if you want at any time that you want.
Well, since the question has come up from Dr. Pierce, I think that this would be an appropriate time to go through it.
Tom, is it possible that we could get a hard copy of that for a point in the discussion today so that the council members have a chance to look at it? Or are you uncomfortable circulating it with the caveat that it hasn't been blessed by the full PDT, which is the normal process?
I am a little uncomfortable providing a paper document that hasn't been thoroughly reviewed by the PDT. I mean, I can always couch what I'm saying now as here is my understanding of what we said. But, you know, once you start circulating the paper, it's going to be, well, this is what the PDT said. And, you know, only one or two PDT members have had a chance to get back to me and say whether or not they agreed with the memo so far.
Okay, so then why don't we just proceed with you speaking with that caveat that not everyone has had a chance to look at what you're about to say.
I think the easiest way for the committee to follow this discussion is if you turn to the document David referred to, which I think is document 14, the Northeast Seafood Coalition letter, and then turn to attachment 1. And if you just take a moment with attachment 1 and go down the left-hand side and number each line, each row, then it'll be easier to follow what I'm saying. Because I'm going to, rather than repeat everything the Seafood Coalition said, I'm just going to say, with respect to row 1, this is what the PDT said about the left-hand side. This is what we said about the right-hand side. So the first page, for example, I guess I should do the same thing. Hang on. So if you do this, I think on the first page you'll get from row 1 to 8. The second page, if I did it right, should be row 9 through 16. We did not comment on the blank line at the bottom, so we don't have to worry about row 20. Now, once again, what I'm about to say is my interpretation of what the PDT said. Just to make it clear, the whole PDT hasn't weighed in. They've all got a copy of the memo, but they didn't. We got it circulated late yesterday afternoon, and not all of them have had a chance to actually review it and provide comments. So these are just my opinions of what we said. With respect to the first line, the coalition raises some concerns about the calculation and the value of the denominator. With respect to the left-hand side, the statement is accurate. If the alternative is applied to all stocks, the denominator will be the same for all stocks. And similarly, the right-hand side is accurate. The denominator will be different for each stock, and it might be affected by appeals or transfers. I would point out that the PDT identified this transfer issue. That is one of the points we raised. That is a technical issue that should be addressed. And one way to address that particular concern is if you do this calculation once, the way the things are at one point in time, then the denominator change doesn't become an issue. Uh, I should offer a general comment here at the start. I should have done it initially. And actually, I'm going to offer three general comments. The first is that in some cases, we're not certain how to interpret the Northeast Seafood Coalition's comments. So we may have deferred analyzing some of that. It also seems that some of these lines are kind of restatements of the same thing. We didn't, if there are nuances that are different, we perhaps didn't pick up on those nuances. A second point is that we're not, the PDT members are not thoroughly familiar with the analyses for the industry-funded buyout. And several of these lines refer to those analyses and say that things either do or do not match up those analyses. Because we're not familiar with a lot of the elements of that analysis, I'm not sure we can comment on whether those statements are accurate or not. And another general comment is several of the comments suggest that the Seafood Coalition proposal is substantially or significantly easier to calculate than the current alternative. In our opinion, and we're not the folks who actually do the calculation at the regional office, but in our opinion, the differences in workload are actually slight. Both alternatives require you to figure out the landings history of each permit, and that's the difficult part. Once you've got the landings history part figured out, applying a capacity formula to all or part of that landings history part of the formula is not terribly difficult. In the PDTs, the guy in the PDT who does it says, you know, it's like a line, extra line of code in your program that does it. So once the landing history component is calculated, and both require that, we don't think that there's really a whole lot more work in applying the capacity component to it. With those three general statements, I'll move on to line two again. In terms of the capacity component, the coalition says each permit will have the same relative value to all sectors. This is really only true for vessels with a Category A day at sea allocation, and it's only true for the capacity component of the formula. The value of each permit isn't going to be based on the capacity component alone. It's going to be based on the combination of the landings history and the capacity component. So, you know, a couple times the Seafood Coalition letter tends to split off and only talk about the capacity component as if we're considering that in isolation. Well, we're not. We're ultimately, people are going to value permits based on the total history assigned to that permit. With respect to the right-hand side, capacity share in the formula is actually higher compared to the proposed alternative since the denominator is smaller. And once again, it's very difficult to distinguish between the capacity value and the landings value of a permit. With respect to line three, the Seafood Coalition restates the formula slightly differently in their alternative than the existing alternative. But as nearly as we can figure out on the PDT, really computationally they're pretty much identical. I mean, you restate them the same way, you can restate them, but the result is the same. And once again, we think the proposed formula is only marginally easier to compute. As I said earlier, once you get the landings history part, applying landings history in a capacity formula, whatever format it takes, is relatively simple. On the right-hand side, they say there's no guidance as to which stocks or vessel baselines the capacity portion of the merged permit should apply to. We don't think that's accurate. NERO has policies in place that evaluate what happens to baselines when permits are combined and what happens to landings history when permits are combined. While perhaps people who haven't combined permits or dealt with the permit office may not be familiar with those guidelines and policies, the policies are in place. They've been used for some time. In fact, I think Framework 42 actually defined some of the policies for the days at sea transfer program when we combined permits. Line four is related. On the left-hand side refers to the industry buyout, and this is one of the items that we refuse to comment on because we're not really familiar with how those values were determined for the industry-funded buyout that was examined. With respect to the right-hand side, We don't think it's accurate to say there's no correlation between vessel length, horsepower, number of allocated days at sea, and the ultimate total quota value of the permit in this option. When we look at the potential sector contribution that results from either way of calculating this capacity alternative, the correlation between what they get, their history, and length, horsepower, and days at sea are very similar under both formulas, which isn't to say that length, horsepower, and days at sea are similar. As I mentioned earlier, some elements are correlated more closely to the history than others. Horsepower is not correlated very well with permit history. Length and days at sea are. But there's really only relatively small differences. I think in one case, the correlation coefficient for one of the alternatives for length is 0.78, and for the other case, it's 0.71. Given the data involved, these are probably just about indistinguishable for how well they correlate with landings history. Number five, promote sector enrollment. By placing a uniform value on every unit of capacity, it creates a platform for a thick market to allow any sector to absorb any permit. We're not really sure we understand this comment. Taken literally, the statement is false. It doesn't place a uniform capacity value on any permit, in particular because, as written, any permit that doesn't have any A days at sea gets no capacity value. But once again, we're not sure that we're correctly interpreting that particular comment. Statement number five, permits will be limited to the geographical range of the stocks they're accredited with. When we had our conference call, we had not yet examined whether this formula results in permits with history in limited areas. Since the conference call, we've worked on some information on that. But even if it does result in that, we're not sure that that's a result to be avoided. There are some members of the PDT, for example, who feel that, if a permit doesn't have any history in over 10 years of fishing, of ever fishing in southern New England, is that a result to be avoided or not? I don't know. Six, I'll just say generally we were not sure we understood this comment at all and we declined to comment. Number seven, once again, this is a statement that seems to be a little bit repetitious. We're not familiar with the industry-funded buyout, so we really can't comment whether one method is consistent. We're also not sure whether that's really relevant to the proposal. On the right-hand side, once again, we think, and we may be wrong on this, that the industry buyout did include a factor that weighed landings and revenues in determining the value of permits. So we're really not sure if the right-hand side is completely accurate with respect to that point. Number eight, this is a comment on the left-hand side that we're not sure we understood, so we declined to comment. On the right-hand side, the current Groundfish Committee version produces results that place more weight on the number of stocks a permit is credited for. This may not be accurate, may not be true. We don't know for sure. But the potential sector contribution of a permit involves two pieces. It involves a landing history piece and a capacity component. The landings component is correlated with many of the capacity elements, as we pointed out earlier. So the total contribution still depends quite heavily on what the landings history is of the permit. And we're not sure that the capacity component is going to outweigh that. We think, in reality, the landings component, for the most part, is going to be the most important piece. Going on to the second page, once again, line 9, this line seems similar to other comments with related to the industry buyout, and we have the same. We declined to make a specific comment because we're not thoroughly familiar with that. Number 10, just as a general statement, I'm not sure we would say any of these alternatives require little or no work by the Fishery Statistics Office. The landings history calculation is going to be difficult. But as I've mentioned earlier, with respect to the left-hand side, we believe that the two alternatives really only have slight differences in the difficulty of calculating potential sector contributions. With respect to the right-hand side, I'm on number 10, right? We think that statement is true. This alternative, the committee's alternative, raises the possibility that the potential gains from fabricating a small amount of landings in a stock area might encourage such activity, or another way of looking at that is the possibility that an error is worth trying to get rectified because the gains might be large, relatively large, compared to the effort to demonstrate 1 pound of landings in a stock area might also encourage more appeals under that approach. So we agreed with that statement. Number 11, this method is easily calculated by individual permit holders and sector managers. Well, this statement is really only true if you're only talking about the capacity component of the calculation. And once again, the value to a sector or to a permit holder is going to be based on the total result. The permit holder still is going to have to comply with many of these confidentiality restrictions to get the landings history component. So, you know, it's only true that you don't have to get confidentiality releases to know what your length and horsepower are, but you're still probably going to have to get that to know what your landings are for the other half. Once your confidentiality requirements are met for the landings history component, it's not difficult to calculate the capacity component. Number 12, we're not sure we can comment on that one. This statement appears very similar to the one on line 4. If you were to look back at my sheet, line 4 is the one where we say we're not thoroughly familiar with the buyout calculations. Number 13, provides a solution to allocating bycatch quota to sectors that may not otherwise receive sufficient allocation of secondary stocks. The problem here that has been identified by the committee and the PDT is that it's possible that a vessel or a permit or the permits in the sector don't have any history of landing something that they encounter rarely. But then they go out in their sector and they encounter this in a rare event, and suddenly they're shut down because they've got zero quota. So whether you call it a bycatch quota or an incidental catch quota, the problem is that, you know, there's a possibility that a sector has some unusual event for which they don't have any quota for. And by giving every sector or every permit potential contribution a tiny little piece of every stock, it might be true that you mitigate this problem to some extent, because everybody's going to have a little bit of everything. So, you know, if they run into something, then they've at least got a little bit that might cover it. Another option that helps to mitigate this problem is if you allow trading of the annual catch entitlement. But if you don't allow trading of this entitlement, as I pointed out, every sector will have at least a little piece of everything, and it does tend to mitigate this bycatch problem. And the same statement kind of applies in reverse to the right-hand side, except we would note that if you allow trading of your annual catch as is proposed by the committee, this helps to mitigate the problem as well. Line 14, we're not clear on the interpretation of this comment, so we did not address it. Number 15, once again, number 15 is an example where the Seafood Coalition's proposal tends to bifurcate, wrong word, but tends to separate out the two components of the permit history and say, well, because you don't have to deal with this issue with one, it makes things easier. Well, in reality, you still got to deal with that issue for the other component. And so in this particular case, it is accurate to say that the coalition's proposal does reduce the reliance on VTRs for determining the capacity component, because the capacity component applies to all stocks. But it doesn't reduce the reliance on VTRs, of course, for the landings component. We know VTRs are known to have errors. Our attribution to stock area right now is based primarily, if not entirely, on VTRs. And so those are conceivably subject to challenge under either alternative. and under the landing's history component as well, whether not just the capacity component. With respect to the right-hand side of the formula, we're a little unclear on this point, but at present anyway, we don't think that the regional office is planning to use different stock attribution methods for different parts of the time period. Our understanding is they're attributing the stocks, attributing a permit's catch to a stock using the same technique for the entire time period of whatever's being proposed. So, yes, it's true that attribution of landings to stock area by VTR may be subject to challenge, but as far as we know, we don't have to worry about there being a different attribution method being used for different time periods. And the last statement, it seems to be similar to some of the other comments. We're not real sure whether, well, we don't feel qualified to judge whether this approach is more similar to the industry buyout or not, because we're not terribly familiar with the industry buyout, and so we declined to comment on that. Now, one of the other things the PDT did is we also looked at the statement of objectives for the comment, for the proposal. And we just went through the statement of objectives, which are, I believe, attachment, it's on the next page of their letter, attachment 2 to their letter. I'll go through these quickly just in order. First objective, and, you know, quite honestly, we feel it's useful to have these objectives because then you can evaluate to some extent whether the proposal is meeting them or not. So it's very helpful to have this stuff listed out. The first statement recognized relative value of financial investments influenced by Amendment 13. We did not have any comment on that objective. You know, I'm not sure we're expert at valuing relative value of permits. That's part of the reason that we tend to defer on these things. Not be entirely beholden to the restrictive confidentiality requirements plaguing FSO. We're not really sure this objective is relevant. It still requires the confidentiality provisions for the landings component, so it doesn't get you out of that completely. Provides a realistic sector alternative for every permit to minimize shifting effort into other fisheries. The problem here is that there's no guarantee that just because a vessel joins a sector, it does not mean it will divert effort into other fisheries. It's entirely possible that vessels may join sectors and still divert effort into other fisheries. Be consistent with the analysis of the industry funded buyout. No PDT comment. The next one, mitigate loss of access to stocks. As a result of the disproportionate impacts from effort regulations and stock range constriction during the baseline period, possibly if the potential sector contributions that result are loud enough to allow fishing on a rebuilt stock. The capacity component, you know, if you have a permit that has zero history, but he has a capacity component, and so he gets a piece of every stock, those capacity components tend to be kind of small. And, you know, if a sector acquires enough of them, okay, then it may give them an opportunity to fish on a future stock. If it doesn't acquire enough of them, then it may not. And this is why we say that it's possible if this potential sector contributions are large enough to allow fishing on rebuilt stocks. Another point we make is that allowing trading of catch entitlements also helps to address this concern that was raised by this objective. Be simple and minimize potential for appeals. Well, it does that only for the capacity component of the formula. It doesn't minimize the potential for appeals on the landing's history side. Be designed to create the least workload to NERO and FSO. As I pointed out a number of times before, we think the workloads for the two are only slightly different. I mean, it's probably accurate to say it does reduce the workload. We're not convinced it reduces the workload a lot, significant amount. Maintain some semblance of compatibility of permits throughout the region so that permits are not trapped in geographic stock ranges. It may not meet this objective. The shares resulting from the capacity components alone tend to be rather small, and absent any landings history, will provide only limited opportunities absent some landings history. And then once again, the last one relates to the industry buyout and investment decisions, and we declined to comment on that objective as well. And I guess that completes what the PDT looked at with respect to this letter.
All right, thanks, Tom. And again, as you said, that's hasn't been blessed by the entire PDT. Just so people are clear.
Yeah, just to be very clear, I mean, that's what I think we agreed to on the conference call. There may be some refinements to that as other people, you know, read the draft memo. They may want to emphasize other points. I don't think they're going to disagree with the substance, but I may have left out something that they think is important.
Okay. I'm going to take a 10-minute break. When I come back, have the council ask questions of Tom if they want to, and then I'll go to the audience on the NSC letter and also on the motion on the board. Thank you. Okay, before the break, we got a unofficial perspective from a discussion the PDT had on a conference call. Again, it's not the official position of the PDT. It's Tom's recollection of what was discussed, but it hasn't been approved by the PDT. Before I go to the council, there was a couple of hanging questions that the PDT had about the letter and about the proposal. I'll ask Vito to come up and make a couple of statements relative to that proposal before we come back to the council, so some of those questions can be answered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vito Gigoloni, Northeast Seafood Coalition. Basically, I think the first thing to point out is that it's unfortunate I wasn't able to attend the PDT meeting, didn't know about it, but I think it would have, it looks like Tom and the PDT fumbled with what understandably was not a document meant to be analyzed by the PDT. It was meant to raise awareness of the points. And this whole thing was in the context, all the side-by-side was in the context of the capacity portion of the analysis. Of the option. It was not meant for the the 50-50 alternative as a whole. So if you look at it in that, and I think that's where, understandably, the PDT looking at a lot of these was they couldn't understand why we thought there'd be less resources involved with FSO. It's for the capacity portion only. That's the broad statement right there. So we listened to the PDT report. The audio is available online, and we listened to it, and it's like, damn, I wish we'd have known and been there and would have been able to answer a lot of these and would have understood the context of the side-by-side and the letter. So, many of the points could have been clarified where it was taken out of context. The confidentiality issue is a big one that I think has been still, I think, overlooked. There's a tracking report that's associated when you request for history. There's a tracking report that is given to you first. It's basically the title report of every permit, and it tells you whether your history for the full period is you have authorization to see it. If you don't have authorization to see it, then you're not going to get allocated for it. What we're trying to do with the version of applying capacity to all stocks is to avoid the necessity to have that tracking report completed all the way back to 96. So there will be a lot of permits that are blocked that can't get the appropriate sign-offs on their permit because of the way they were transferred, that are going to be beholden to getting any of their capacity credit on stocks as a result of being blocked on that history. Whereas capacity, length, horsepower, and days are things that most people have already gone through appeals processes, understand and accept, and would be a quick and simple calculation. So in general, that was where we saw that the PDT's view of this was not taken in the context of the intent of the side-by-side comparison.
Okay, some clarification. Back to the council. Any discussion? Dave Cato.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Before we go kind of hopelessly round and round here, I think we almost need to divide these questions and have some discussion on two issues. because each of these three alternatives that are up there at the moment contain an aspect of landings and an aspect of equity of allocation. And I think if we try to deal with them both at once, we're going to be in a hopeless mess, basically. I'd like to have a discussion of landings and where we are with landings and what we can do with landings, what we can't do with landings. I have a number of questions for the service or the service's representatives that I'd like to ask through you about landings. And then at some point, I'd like to have a discussion about equity. How do we treat all fishermen fairly in this process? And make sure that we have alternatives here that do, in fact, treat all fishermen fairly, that don't, bias ourselves towards one segment of the industry or another. So, again, with your indulgence, if you would like to divide the question that way, I would like to spend an hour or two on each one and really get some of these issues out in the open.
I don't think that's a bad idea. Unless I'm mistaken, there's three alternatives that the committee's forwarded to the council. Two of them are based purely on landings history. And there's another alternative that has a component that's landings history and then a component that's termed a capacity formula or capacity segment. And I think even before we get into the questions that you have, Dave, I think we need to answer a more fundamental question, which is that the council needs to be clear what it's trying to get out of an allocation formula for sectors. You know, the PDT is stated, I think, repeatedly in its notes to the committee and to the that have been available as well to the council, that we need to define what it is we're trying to achieve, what the goals are, what the objectives are of this allocation. And I'm pretty sure that we haven't done that, unless somebody around the table wants to point me to a list of goals and objectives for this allocation decision. Yeah, I didn't think they existed. Of course, you can go back to Amendment 13, and there were goals for sector allocation written there, and that might be a good place to start the discussion. I believe in one of our documents, those goals are restated, and I'll ask Tom if he can remember which document they're in, and I suggest we turn to that.
I believe, I think what you're referring to is document number 6, which is a PDT report of a meeting held January 9th. And item 6 on page 3. Summarizes, quite honestly, as the judge said, the discussion in Amendment 13 is not a matter of draftsmanship, but in that section, these bullets are highlighted as what some of the benefits are of sectors or what the objectives are of sectors. Provides incentives to self-govern, reducing the need for council-mandated measures. Provide a mechanism for capacity reduction through consolidation. Assurance that members of the sector might not face reductions of catch or effort as a result of actions of vessels outside the sector. Freedom from restrictive regulations not needed to meet conservation objectives if the sector is constrained by a hard tag.
I think those are the ones you're referring to.
Yeah, and after hearing them and reading them again, it's not exactly what I was looking for. We don't have a statement or goals about allocation. We have these bullets more pertain to, as you stated, the benefits of sectors and perhaps some policy discussions or on how sectors will be treated. I think what I'm looking more for is, or suggesting that we consider, is, why are we allocating? How are we allocating? What are we hoping to achieve through the allocation? Something along those lines. Dana Pierce. Dana Rice, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm a little reluctant to jump in here, but I think, in my case, the the blend of capacity and history interests me, because as been stated, capacity allows small, limited access, and what we're trying to do with the sectors, what I think we need to do with sectors, it's been a long, difficult process, and the sectors and the allocation has been very difficult, as I understand it, everywhere it's been done ahead of us. But it allows industry some flexibility, I think, in a time while we're trying to rebuild the resource. And one of the things I want to see in the sector, and one of the why it appeals to me with the mix of the 50-50 or whatever capacity in history, is it allows us to keep people fishing today, and as what I want to see, or what I'm hoping to see, and I'm curious about how the rest of the council members feel about it, as fish stock comes back, it allows more and broader and flexible access to go after these fisheries, or these different species of fish. And I think one of the things that I see being left out, I'm not articulating this very well, I know, but one of the things I see left out of this is if I think we're going to embrace this, I think we need to have it as broad and open as we can for the future, and I think there needs to be some mechanism when fisheries are rebuilt, a certain species of fisheries are rebuilt in the areas of people are fishing them, that we may need to look back at this and divide up the percentages or divide up the poundage or using the percentage allocation that we have in place. I guess I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman. I think some people probably understand what I'm trying to say. Thank you.
Dr. Pearson.
To your point, Mr. Chairman, your question regarding what direction should we go and for what reason, in other words, what are we trying to accomplish, once we have that specified, or at least once we have some idea as to what we want to do, it'll make it easier for us to deal with the questions raised by people like David Gethel, others, and, of course, the motion on the board. First and foremost to me, regarding what we're trying to accomplish, is for us to maintain consistency with our sector policy. We spent a lot of time developing a sector policy. We had an omnibus group at first, and that fell away, and then we ended up with a policy that's specific to each and every committee. And I'll just draw your attention to one element of the sector policy that I think needs to be an objective, that is something we want to try to achieve, and that is in the allocation sector, where it says that individual species committees, the groundfish committee in this particular case, in considering sector proposals, must consider bycatch and other fisheries. But the one that draws my attention and that we need to focus on as an objective, otherwise all will be lost, that is effort displacement and the impact on common pool non-sector vessels. In other words, our objective should be not to just displace effort into other areas and other fisheries and not create a situation whereby our allocation strategy puts the common pool vessels at a tremendous disadvantage to the point where they don't exist anymore. That's a possibility. So I'd like us to work in that direction, to focus on that. In addition, this is a very important point, and it was raised by the coalition and by many others, and of course I'm well aware of it because of my dealings with many fishermen who have called me, my office, about sectors, and that is, can they support them? I want an alternative, and I'm not sure which one it is, but I want an alternative that will definitely get support from the majority of the groundfish fleet. Obviously, if we pick an alternative that the majority of the groundfish fleet says is no good, inappropriate, for whatever reasons they may list, then we go down a difficult road. Sectors need to be supported. We want people to get into sectors, at least that's my understanding. We want to promote sector enrollment. That would be another objective, to promote sector enrollment. And here's another one that to me is important, and it's come up a number of times. It's in light of the numbers of regulations, the nature of regulations we've had in place for quite a long time, the rolling closures, the trip limits, and other regulations that have had some geographical impacts, let's say inequitable geographical impacts. I'd like to see us pick an alternative that potentially, you know, would minimize the penalty that a fisherman would incur, specifically if their performance, past performance, their catch history was affected by regulations having geographic effects on catch and affecting their fishing opportunities, then I would want to minimize that impact caused by those things. Rolling closures, for example, the catch history of many vessels has been diminished dramatically in recent years because of the rolling closures. We all know that. And other regulations that we've had to implement to deal with mortality. And here's one that is important to me, but again, I don't know which alternative on the board or one we may put on the board that will address the specific concern, and that is the Days at Sea leasing program in particular. It seems to me that the current regulations with which we're working, Framework 42, socioeconomic impact was considered to be quite significant, and that impact was mitigated by the Days at Sea leasing program. That's the underpinning of Framework 42. Days at Sea leasing program mitigates the socioeconomic impacts. Which of these alternatives, there or others, will enable us to minimize the undoing of any of the mitigation that came about through the Days at Sea leasing? And I don't pretend to have to fully grasp that, but we know that fishermen have done many creative things over the last few years relative to getting Days at Sea through leasings, you know, buying permits and getting the Days at Sea from those permits, using those Days at Sea. I would hate to see that those fishermen who have made those investments, businessmen, perfectly legal, they've had to survive. They've taken advantage of mitigation elements of Framework 42, supposed mitigation elements of Framework 42. I don't want to see them suddenly be put out on the edge of the plank and told to jump off because they no longer have permits with any real value, even though they've invested in those permits, $300,000, $400,000. You know, the cost of these permits has been quite significant. So that, to me, would be an objective for us to pursue, not to negate those potential benefits coming about through mitigation of Framework 42. We've talked about another benefit, and I can't really get into it, and I'm not going to get into it because no one will fully understand it. I think I know that Tom has referenced it, and that's the industry-funded buyout measures of capacity and permit value. There is an equation in the buyout program that was put on the shelf. My understanding is that that equation basically is the equation that the coalition has supported and others have supported in New England. I'd hate to deviate from that equation now for the buyout. Might complicate matters. And then another one, I would love to see us avoid the complications, the serious complications that will arise from having to calculate history of vessel histories by area or by stock. I think someone mentioned it, maybe it was Tom, that now we use the VTR to determine where vessels' catches have come from. I've heard many people say in the past, including the analysts, that it's very difficult to know where a fisherman's actually getting their catch. Of course, we've been operating with that problem for many years now. But since we're going to allocation, this is the allocation amendment, we're going to make fateful decisions about who gets what. If we now put ourselves in a position where we have to, with some high degree of accuracy, determine a fisherman's catch from this area, that stock, and this stock, and that database is so uncertain that we really leave ourselves open to appeals that will slow down this whole process and undercut our ability to be successful with sectors, I don't want to go there. So the alternatives that are up on the board, I'm going to be further debating them with the council relative to these particular points that I've just raised, things I'd like to see us achieve, and then hopefully put together a list that would include an alternative that would enable me to see those objectives achieved. So with that said, Mr. Chairman, that's my foray into the discussion of what we're trying to achieve through this amendment that we're developing relative to allocation.
Thanks, David. again, all of the alternatives on the board, and I believe all of the alternatives that have been considered by the committee over the past year have included at least some element of historical catch. I'm aware, as I'm sure most people are around the table, that there are varying degrees of confidence in utilizing catch history. But I put those questions and concerns in the camp of technical questions. I want to elevate the discussion above those technicalities and attempt to get the council to be more clear on what it is it's trying to accomplish with its allocation choice ultimately, so that when we get down to the final discussion or decision, we're not exposed. Okay, I think we need to do a good job of defining what it is we're trying to accomplish and why ultimately we choose what we choose, and does it line up with the goals of our allocation choice. You know, there are people that believe that pure history is the fairest way to go or the most equitable way to go for their own rationale. There are people that think that there's plenty of reasons not to rely purely on catch history and to incorporate some other methods, whether it's days at sea as a factor, allocated days at sea. Other people have suggested, and indeed we have an alternative in front of us that includes what's called a capacity factor. Okay, these are all great ideas, but why at the end of the day do we pick one over another? Is it just a matter of how many people raise their hand for a particular decision, or are we going to be more clear about what it is we're trying to accomplish in this decision? John Nelson.
Now, Mr. Chairman, the ability to provide those objectives, I think, are somewhat limited right now because what's on the board. In order to really have objectives, I think you need to have a broad range of alternatives that provide you with that option of selecting what fits best to your objectives. My sense is that we have the two alternative one and two are narrower than what I think the council probably would want to have as its availability when it ultimately gets to the point of saying which one of these or combination of these fits the objectives that we've laid out. And I would suggest, and I don't know if it's the appropriate time to suggest another alternative, Mr. Chairman, but I think if we do put in a third alternative that broadens the range, that may provide us with the opportunity to develop those alternatives and be able to then select one at some point in the future after all analysis is done and so on, to most closely fit the objectives that we have developed and that I'm hearing David and others expound upon. So having said that, would it be appropriate, Mr. Chairman, if I propose another alternative that would be put into the mix for analysis and hopefully objectives could flow from the range that I think would be provided by this third alternative?
Before I answer your specific question, I guess I'll try to get at what I was trying to get at. I may not be doing a good job of articulating it, but are people satisfied that, or are they comfortable with the direction we're heading, and do they feel that we've been clear about what it is we're hoping to accomplish? Jim Odlin, then Jim Salisbury.
Well, having worked on the Groundfish Committee, the objectives that I had been working under were the objectives that were a cumulative bunch of objectives that aren't laid out, you're right, in any one place. There are the Amendment 13 objectives, the Framework 42 objectives, and the objectives that the Act itself tells us we have to do when we allocate, and that's be fair and equitable, recognizing past and present participation in the fisheries. So that's how, personally, I've been working on the committee. Now, the committee did have a bunch of other options on the table and took them out because we were rushing. So if we were going to start with more alternatives, I think we ought to put the other alternatives that the committee had been working on and put them back up as a starting place, because they may actually be one of, I don't know what John's thinking of proposing, but one of them may be already done. I'm not sure, but there. So, I think I understand clearly what you're looking for. I don't think I'm ready to be able to sit down and write a motion that says, you know, we want to be fair and objective, we want to be transparent, we want to be this, we want to incorporate the incentives here of self-governments, capacity reduction, and all that. But I think that's what you're looking for. And I think that's going to take some time to develop, and maybe that should go back to the committee. You know, but I clearly understand what you're looking for, but can't get you there right here.
Thank you. Jim Salisbury?
Well, I think Jim has expressed some of the thoughts that I have, but Dr. Pierce, when he first made a motion to let's look at the objectives that we have to see whether we, you know, what those are, I think was on the right track. And I think his comment that just, even though that motion was defeated, his comments keep suggesting that we should really be doing that, and I agree with him. I think that while the Groundfish Committee may well have had some clear objectives in mind, we don't know what those are yet. They have not been presented if they had them. And so, from my perspective, we are doing much of what Jim did in his own mind. He said, well, I'm thinking of Amendment 13, I'm thinking of Framework 42, and I'm thinking of all the other reasons why that we're guided, all the other things that guide us, and so those are the things that I'm using as objectives. But I think the council right now, and I don't know if it will take that long, but we should go through those the relevant points in Amendment 13, Framework 42, look at what those are, and then prior to doing anything with these alternatives, give consideration and come up with what we think the objective is of this amendment, because we can change if we don't like something in Amendment 13 that we think is irrelevant now, say it, do it, get it on the table, and then it makes it much easier to look at these and see whether they are conducive to achieving what your objectives are. Right now, I have difficulty because my idea of what we're trying to accomplish probably eliminates a couple this and Vito's variation on alternative two. But if our objective were different, it may not. You know, so I think that's something that we have to do before we can start discussing which alternative achieves our objectives, but we don't know what they are. So, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Rule, then Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, David Pierce touched on one of the concerns Mid-Atlantic's got, and that's the shift of effort that's going to result from this. But before I get into that, I wanted to thank you for setting up this meeting. I think you recognize the importance of it, and I appreciate with budget concerns where they are, what you've done to provide that. With that said, being a voting member of the Groundfish Committee, I'm extremely frustrated with where we are now. Considering the regional administrator's letter of December the 7th and our comments at the November meeting, from not only from the regional office but from the Science Center when they talked about the budget issues and the reality of this, and being involved with the committee back in early summer when the Amendment 16 was actually being drafted and the consideration actually passed the committee that the Amendment 16 not include issues such as sectors but deal specifically with the required GARM midterm review.
That has been changed, and I understand that. And I did miss some committee meetings. But it's time to ask a more fundamental question to this group and the agency and everybody involved so the industry doesn't have false expectations. And that's my biggest concern right now, the way we're going with this. And, I think devoting this entire day to trying to resolve some of these issues is beneficial. The bigger question is, can it physically be done in 16? Is the reality that it's going to happen there? Or are we talking doing part of these sectors as opposed to everything that's been submitted? That's the driving question. To me, the suggestion that was made during the committee meeting was get the allocation process complete. Meet the required midterm review. Meet all the actions that were absolutely necessary, court mandated in 16. Get the allocation process developed and completed, and then determine at that point, do we want to go to sectors? Do we want to go to something different? Might have been a combination of area management point system, days at sea, modified. I don't know what it would have been, and none of us know now. But until the allocation process is complete, we don't know. MID's concern is, with this process here, if where boats are going to shift effort into stocks that we manage down there. But, Mr. Chairman, the concern I've got when you look at this holistically, the sectors were determined to be voluntary. In Amendment 13, they were. You had a small group that came forward and asked for an allocation. The common pool's concern at that point was whether or not that was going to be a permanent allocation, a temporary allocation, or what it was, because nobody knew. It was not the concern that the common pool's got today, which is if we don't get in a sector, we're out. Our ass is done. And we have removed the voluntary portion of sectors if we go down this road the way we're going now. And if it's not clear, and if we don't have good guidance that the time that we have to do the analysis that Tom and the PDT and everyone else has to do can't be done, somebody's got to have enough nerve to say it. And don't mislead this industry. They came forward, they honored the request and the suggestion of the council to come up with something better, different. They did that to a level that nobody expected, that to some degree we still don't understand. But I just think it's wrong to keep going down the road like we know this is going to happen, and all of a sudden the axe is going to fall, and none of it's going to happen. And I'm scared of that one. I really am, because I think you lose industry confidence in the process. I think part of the industry, the entire industry, is doing everything it can to survive. We don't know what the results of the GARM are going to be, but they certainly don't look good. Any action that is taken now is in response to that. And it's unfortunate to be in this position at this time, but I still think, Mr. Chairman, that the allocation issues need to be paramount, and it needs to be a discussion of this group as to whether or not it can physically happen in Amendment 16. And if it can't, just have the decency to say so. I think that's a discussion that should take place, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. I think we will have that discussion. I had Dave Gaethel, and then I had Dave Preble.
Okay. I think from listening to everybody, our overriding goal here, or the goal, is a conversion of currency from days at sea to a quota-based system. That, when you distill all this down, that's what it amounts to. And for objectives, our objectives are to do it in an equitable manner, to distribute that quota equitably. And equity, of course, is in the eyes of the beholder. Now, if you're a vessel that fishes throughout the range and catches the whole range of species, you want to have a purely history-based system because you catch everything. If you're not that person, or if you've changed permits, or for whatever reasons, then a whole number of other issues, such as Dr. Pierce listed, start to enter into that equation. And therefore, you have to look for some perfections of your objectives. So you want to, for example, smooth out geographic inequalities that have existed during your qualification criteria, since it's already been pretty well accepted that we can't go back to a period prior to when some areas operated under geographic constraints. You also would, I would hope, as an objective, maybe the council doesn't agree with me on this, but you want to try and smooth out economic unknowns that have occurred previously when people entered into transactions using the coin of the realm at the time, which was days at sea, and now find that the conversion rate has changed the value of their coins. So, you have a lot of economic unknowns that have occurred since Amendment 13 with the judge's decision. Things like leasing have perverted the system. All these transfers of permits, differential counting, have caused people to buy up permits at an unprecedented rate because they need to survive until 2009. In a sense, they don't even care what happens after that because they still have to be here when the bell rings May 1st, 2009. And as such, they've invested enormous amounts of money in trying to be here till 2009 without knowing that somebody was going to change the conversion rate come May 1st, 2009. So, we have to try and, I would hope, somehow smooth that out as well. So anything that's based, to me, purely on catch history is too simplistic. It doesn't account for all these other circumstances that have occurred that are largely beyond the vast majority of people's control. And so, again, I would say our goal is to provide that conversion, and then our objectives would be to list a series of objectives that make that as fair to the entire industry as we can possibly make it. And we should also state in there as an objective, quite frankly, that no matter what we do, we can't make it 100% fair to 100% of the people. We just can't do it, because in order to do that, we'd have to provide an individual conversion rate for each person, which we have no ability to do. In other words, no matter what we do, it's a broad brush approach. And as such, it isn't going to fit every business plan that's out there, because if there's, whatever there are, 1,400-odd permits at the moment, there's 1,400-odd business plans. And we can't write up 1,400-odd motions to satisfy every one of those people. But I think we can go a long ways towards satisfying the concerns of the vast majority of those people, that they were treated as equitably as they could be treated in this currency conversion. And so I hope that simplifies things to a point where maybe we could start listing them.
Thanks, Dave. Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm actually more hopeful right now than I've been all day. This is exactly the kind of discussion we need to be having, and I particularly appreciate what Dr. Fiss said about objectives. And what John Nelson said about completion of what we have here, and Jim Odlin also added to that that there were other alternatives that were on the board, and most of them were eliminated without too much discussion as being impractical. There was one other that at this point, whether we adopt it or not, remains to be seen, but I have a sense of incompletion of what's up here right now, because whatever direction we take, there was one other that was contentious at the committee level and I think needs to be put back on the board for consideration, and that is alternate number two with it applied across all geographic areas. It was discussed at length at the committee meeting, and the vote was close. It was a contentious issue, and in light of the fact that that's the position of the Northeast Seafood Alliance, who has so many of the sectors under their wing, I think at this point we really need to put that back on the board. However it turns out, I'm not trying to complicate the issue, but I do think we need to put that at least back on the board to take a look at it. And so I would offer that as a motion that we add an alternative three, which would be essentially identical to alternative two, except it would apply across all geographic areas.
I understand. I can sense that a lot of people want to jump right back into the alternatives and the discussions. Before I call for a second on your motion, I'll ask you to just withdraw it for a second, and,
sure,
and we'll get back.
Yeah, I want to fulfill a sense of incompletion I have,
sure,
with what we're dealing with. Thank you.
I understand that, and it's my plan to, with the council's consent, to ask the committee to continue this discussion that we started today on the goals of what it is we're trying to achieve, unless there's an objection. I think Jim Salisbury and Jim Odlin put it better than I just did, but to task the committee with completing this discussion and coming back to the council with suggested goals and objectives for this allocation discussion. I had Jim Odlin, then Dave Simpson, then John Nelson.
I mean, I took a stab at a motion, John, if you want to go that route, or I'm fully in support of sending this to the committee. It's the chairman's. I took a stab at a motion to come up with some goals and objectives. If you want to work that out here, I can do it. If you'd rather have a motion to send it to the committee, I think that's probably the best approach, and I can make a motion to that effect if that would help the process. I guess it's which way do you think we ought to go here? Hash out some goals and objectives now or send it to the committee?
All right, we have a motion on the board right now. If the council wants to go forward and try to do the goals right now, that'd be fine. We have time today to do this. It doesn't have to be the complete list of the goals that we're striving for, but it may be beneficial to put them up on the board. Rodney?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I definitely think that's the way we need to go, because there's a lot of people here that are confused. They don't understand it. And if you have them up there so people could see them, they'll probably understand it. We'll work to a solution.
I'll ask the committee chair to withdraw the committee motion. Just clear the board.
I'll withdraw.
Okay. Rip?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to concur with the thought that we should try and move ahead and put some of these goals up today. I have been working on a list as we have been going along here. If Jim has a list and Dr. Pierce has some, maybe we could take a couple-minute break and put our heads together, come up with a list, and get it up on the board so we can at least take a look at that. And at that point in time, if we decide that we pare it down or work on it a little bit and send it back to the committee for fine-tuning, I think that is a better process. But I will also say that sending things back to the committee, you know, we're at 5 minutes to 12, and it's just, you know, we're struggling, and I'm just saying that honestly, we're struggling to get done what it is we need to get done at this point. So I think we're here today to do these things. The more that we can hash this out, the better we'll be.
Any objection to that? Okay, we'll take a 10 to 15-minute break. Okay.